Okay, folks, it's a few minutes after, and I think it's time to get started. My name is Declan McCullough. I'll be the moderator for the debate. Let's move it up a bit. My name is Declan McCullough. I'll be the moderator for your debate today. We have 1 hour that we're going to divvy up into chunks, starting with opening statements for 5 minutes each, and then moving on to back and forth. I'm going to give the two debaters the opportunity to ask each other questions. They don't have to, but it would kind of forfeit those a few minutes that they could, if they're good at cross-examination, use to their advantage. By way of background, I work for CNET, part of CBS, as their chief political correspondent, which means because we're a technology site, a lot of technology politics and policy, and I've covered privacy for and pseudonymity and anonymity and those issues those raise for about 15 years. So we have two distinguished panelists or debaters today, and my problem is that they actually are friends and agree on too much. And so what it was a really weird discussion via email. They said, well, no, I don't really want to do this as a formal debate because that might lead to hard feelings, and so there's some negotiation going on. Generally, as a moderator, you kind of keep people separated because they're at each other's throats. So my job and your job during the Q&A phase is to make sure that we actually identify disagreements here. Cindy, to my right and your left, is the legal director for the Electronic Frontier Foundation and its general counsel. Cindy has been involved in privacy issues and EFF since the mid-1990s, including some of the encryption cases, the Bernstein case back then. Colette, to my left, your right, is a senior copyright attorney at Microsoft, but she points out that she is not representing Microsoft here. She is wearing a different hat, which is president and co-founder of a nonprofit called Without My Consent that deals with online privacy violations, and that's the hat that she's wearing here. The way I think anonymity online evolved is initially the social norm was pseudonyms allowed. I mean, this was the case throughout the 80s and 90s, and Facebook probably changed that, and we became more accepting of full disclosure. At least that was the social norms moved in that direction. Twitter moved back towards pseudonymity, and Google Plus has had a long and complicated history in just the last 8 or 9 months, and a month or two ago they announced their policy, which is essentially if you are known by another name and you can prove it, then you can use that name here, but you may not be able to, but maybe you can't actually start that pseudonym here at Google Plus. So we have 5 minutes of intro and basic positions, and then we'll move into the debate. And because Colette is taking the affirmative, which is anonymity online should be restricted, I'm going to ask her to start.
Great. Hello. Thanks, Declan, for the introduction. And it's great to be back at South by Southwest. So I'm going to present this as an argument, as I would to a business person who's thinking about launching a social site and whether they should allow their users to be 100% anonymous in that context. And so with that, I see this question of anonymity as you can restate it as essentially whether your social site should provide for some form of real-world responsibility for users' actions. I propose that social sites and the online communities they create are better served by providing for accountability of user actions. To enable accountability, sites cannot provide anonymity for all users for all times. And I have three basic reasons for this position. The first reason is it's good for your business. Social sites are dependent on users sharing and connecting with their peers, experimenting, learning, cataloging information, entertaining themselves, and all sorts of different things in the platform or community that the social site has created. What kind of home you want to create for your users depends on what kind of environment you want to have. Do you want to have a cesspool where people are going to be doing a lot of flaming and trolling and making people uncomfortable and harassing and doing things that are patently illegal? Or do you want a place that's trustworthy and open, encourages civil debate, encourages disagreement, but not always in the context where kind of the race to the bottom of negative comments and comments that are going to be harmful to people in real world ways? So by requiring users of your social site to provide some form of identity, either a real name or an identifiable pseudonym, and retaining some of that information for a period of time, your social site will encourage a more civil and safe environment because participants will understand and are accountable that they are accountable at some point for their actions. Just as stalkers and offline harassers are accountable in real life, they should know that their actions will be traceable, if need be, in the real world. Ultimately, this will create a better destination and a better place for your business to monetize all of that. And the value that the site will provide will increase exponentially, and that's one reason why it's good for your business. Secondly, and I think actually more importantly, by not allowing 100% anonymity, you will be encouraging more speech and more free speech on your sites. And this might be counterintuitive to some people, but if a site permits 100% anonymity, there will be a whole lot of important and at least equally valuable speech that will be lost or chilled on the internet. And I'm talking about the speech of people who are being harassed and people who are not able to enter these communities and feel safe. So you're basically valuing the speech of the haters and the people who are going to degrade the value of the website in favor of people who have really valid things to say and really important points of view to express, but do not feel like they can do it in a safe way in those environments. We've seen this happen with people who reach out to my nonprofit without my consent for help. It's been documented by researchers like Danielle Citron. She wrote a law review article called Laws, Expressive Values, and catalogs a lot of ways in which people's speech, mostly in her articles, it's about women, but I think there's a lot of other communities whose speech gets lost because they don't want to be in that environment. And when looking at the harms of online privacy, violations and harassment, I've seen it personally myself in my former practice before I joined Microsoft, where I worked with victims who helped clean up their reputation and hold their harassers accountable. Even when we'd succeeded in a lawsuit, the harm has been done and the victim remains reluctant and to go online and very much withdraws from online activities. So once victims withdraw from those communities, they disengage from the internet and their speech is lost from the vibrant marketplace that we have. And that's, in short, silencing a huge number of people that shouldn't be silenced. So by requiring some form of accountability, we value all speech, and we put it on equal footing. Society will benefit from the availability of all kinds of speech online, and this will encourage free speech. The third point is that it's the right thing to do. I have less than a half a minute, so I'm going to rush through this. It's an ethical and moral appeal. While it's not legally required, certainly in the U.S., to be as an intermediary and providing a platform to police the speech of third parties who provide content on your site, there are good moral and ethical reasons to require that. When it comes to who is harmed by the hateful conduct, it's often people who are marginalized and disenfranchised in the world generally. Everybody is living in a more combined online and offline world.
Time's
so
up.
Not having accountability equates to throwing the rule of law out the window. Thanks.
Cindy, you get an extra 10 seconds.
Thank you very much. I appreciate South by Southwest by letting me and my good friend Colette disagree publicly about things. And it is true. I asked Colette to do this because she's one of the few people on the other side of this debate who really makes me stop and think. And I think that the debate, there's plenty of people who could come up and try to debate anonymity with me who I think it's fair to say I would crush. And Colette's not one of them. And so I do appreciate her taking the time to do this. I think that the debate around whether a social site should allow anonymity online is based fundamentally on a false proposition. And that false proposition is if you make people identify themselves, they will be nicer to each other. And I would submit to you that I grew up in a town of 8,000 people in the middle of Iowa, and just because people know your name, your dad's name, where you live, and what you ate for breakfast does not make them nicer to each other. In fact, anybody who's ever grown up on an island has lots of stories about island culture around these kinds of things. So I think that there is a real problem with women especially, but I think across the board, minorities and small speakers being harassed online. And I think that people reaching for answers to this solution are reaching for eliminating anonymity because it feels like something you can do. But I don't think it's the right answer. I don't think it'll solve the underlying problem. I think people are perfectly happy to harass each other even when their name is known. I also think there are plenty of ways of getting around real name policy so that when you've got the worst of the worst actors, they're going to find ways around it, and there's not a way to legislate people to being nice to each other. So let me go through Colette's three points because I think I disagree on all three of them. The first one is that it's good for your business. I think that for people who are creating a space for other people to speak, it's actually bad for your business to have a real names policy. Why? Because it makes you the enforcer. It makes you in a position where you've got to figure out if people are telling you the truth all the time and enforce it when they're not. And this is a huge compliance burden. It turns you into some version, I heard Danny just say this, it turns you into some version of the DMV, right? Where you're going to try to make sure that people aren't faking, or the passport control people. Because otherwise you're not doing enough of your job in order to try to make sure people have real names policy. Or you have a half-assed policy, which doesn't help the people you're trying to help and annoys the people who are trying to do the right thing. So I think that you should not overestimate or underestimate the compliance problem, the never-ending responsibility that you create by trying to police a real names policy. And I think that the I hate to quote Kevin Costner, but if you build it, they will come. That if you have a trove and a cache of people connecting people's online identities to their real identities, you have problems both with law enforcement all around the world coming to you to try to identify people who are saying unpopular things, and you might be perfectly willing to identify somebody who's harassing somebody else on your site, but I don't think you're going to feel that same way about an Arab dissident or a Chinese dissident when those governments come knocking. And even if it's a country that is... has a different standard for defamation or other things than this country, a country like the United Kingdom, for instance, where we have all sorts of, you know, it may be hard for the Chinese government to force an American-based company or a European-based company to turn over the identity of someone. You've got a lot of arguments that you're not subject to their jurisdiction. However, if it's a UK company, you probably are, and you're probably going to have to respond, at least if you have customers there. If you build it, they will come, and they will come, and they will be the governments and people who don't share your values about free speech. And if you build it, they will come in terms of identity theft. If you're a big cache of connecting people's identities, you're going to be a target for people who want to use those identities to try to pretend to be other people for purposes of getting credit card and gambling debts and other things. And I just think that's a big responsibility, and people should think about whether that's what they want to take on. In terms of encouraging speech, the second point, I think I disagree again. I think that we live in a country that was built on the fact that people put forth unpopular ideas anonymously. The Federalist Papers were not signed, and neither were the responses to them. And I think if we throw away that history and think that the only good ideas come from people who identify themselves, we've lost something fundamental, frankly, in our country. The second thing is that whether it's the right thing to do or not, and I think the Arab Spring is a good example, and there are many others, where allowing people the space to say unpopular things and to create unpopular ideas and allowing unpopular people to speak is a way that you do the right thing, not the wrong thing. How's that?
Okay, nicely done. In timing, I'm not taking a position on the actual content of the remarks. Now we have the best case for disallowing anonymity online. This will just be 3 minutes timed, and we can move to rebuttals. Colette.
Well,
you feel free to sit.
That's
right. It could be exactly right. What is the best case for disallowing anonymity online?
So I think the best way to illustrate the case for disallowing anonymity online is to talk about some real-world examples, things that I think will resonate well, especially with the audience at South by Southwest. Many of you may have heard about the story of Kathy Sierra from a number of years ago. She was a prominent blogger, game developer, computer programmer, and she had a blog called Creating Passionate Users. In 2007, she was attacked anonymously on her own blog after she had been writing about a variety of things. It really relatively thoughtful and not controversial in the attacking sense. Posters suggested that she deserved to have her throat slit, be suffocated, sexually violated, and hanged. They posted her home address and social security number. They doctored photographs of her. One picture featured her with a noose behind beside her neck. Another depicted her screaming while being suffocated by lingerie. After the attack, she canceled many, if not all, of her speaking engagements. She feared leaving her home. As she explained, quote, "My blog was the Technorati Top 100 at the time of the attack. I have not blogged there since or anywhere since." So this is an example of a real-life situation where someone has been completely pushed offline, and we're losing really valuable and important conversations that can happen. Another example is also real life, this famous case, well, at least in our circles, involving the website AutoAdmit. And that had horribly defamatory and vicious statements made about a bunch of, or a few female law students. The statements were things like the women wanted to be raped or deserved to be raped, that they there were hate-filled descriptions of how posters wanted to sexually assault the women and statements that the women were universally hated and had bribed. The impact was objective. They would damage their employment prospects. They wouldn't get certain interviews. They wouldn't get into so they were objective harms, you know, not getting a job, because people search your name and see these things. And then they were also subjective, very emotionally devastating. And the victims would never be the same, ever. And so I think these cases illustrate the reason why having some form of accountability, some way to get the person who's making these statements to be held accountable by the victims. If they want to sue them, they can sue them and find out their identity and after appropriate process, but they need an opportunity to go after them if they want.
Thank you. Also, 2.8 seconds under. Thank you very much.
Colette's making up time.
Okay, so now we move into the rebuttal and cross-examination phase. We won't actually call it that because they're friends, but that's what it amounts to. So, Cindy, you have two-minute chunks, 4 minutes total. The first is 2 minutes to ask questions of Colette. You're not required to use it, but it's a use it or lose it, and you can cut her off politely, I hope, if she filibusters. So any questions you'd like to pose to your opponent? You have 2 minutes.
Well, I guess my first question for Colette is, you know, what is the evidence that you have that removing anonymity will stop harassment? Because everybody hates harassment. I mean, believe me, I'm a woman online as well.
Yeah, so I think there have been a few blogs who have taken the Facebook approach, required Facebook logins in order to make comments on the blogs. I think TechCrunch had done it at least a year ago, maybe longer. And they documented or articulated numerous times that they believe that the comments on their blogs are more relevant to the articles, are not as, I guess, extreme maybe. And we'll lose some speech by doing this, for sure. But we're creating a place where people feel like, oh, I can't just go and do something really horrible and pretend like it'll never come back I will never be accountable for it. That's my main piece of evidence. TechCrunch. Sorry.
Well,
I'm sure there's more.
But I think that, I asked the question because I don't think there is any a scientific or serious analysis that's been done. And I will.
Hold on. Do you have any questions? We can move to rebuttal in a moment. Any other questions?
What happened to AutoAdmit?
So I think there were a lawsuit was filed on behalf of the women. They had named a bunch of different, you know, username things from the forum, and a number of the people were unmasked, but a lot of them were not. So some people were held somewhat accountable. I think the case settled, so I'm assuming they learned their lesson. But a number of people were able to just walk away from that, having contributed to the hateful and harmful environment that, that AutoEmit created. AutoEmit itself also went under recently. So
okay, so now we move to rebuttals. If you have a rebuttal,
sure.
You can't ask questions except rhetorical ones.
Okay, well, I think that I disagree about what happened in AutoEmit. So AutoEmit went under. It went under almost immediately. And there was a lawsuit against the pseudonymous people. And the people who got identified were all the people who spoke. And the court refused to identify people who were just participants but who hadn't said anything bad. And that was how the line was drawn. There is a test in the law that EFF helped develop. It gets called the Dendrite test that sets the conditions under which a service provider, be it an ISP or a social network or anyone, has to reveal the identities of people who are otherwise acting anonymously, at least to the extent that they have them. The test was met in AutoEmit for all the people who said all the horrific things. The people who sued in AutoEmit tried to get other people who were participants in the forums but who hadn't said anything bad identified as well, and the court refused to do that. I think that's the right decision. And the whole website fell, and the people were able to be identified. I think AutoEmit is a good example of why the system isn't broken and doesn't need fixing. There's a test. Most of the time, for most of the forums, there is a way to identify people. Even if the forum doesn't have the name of their users, they generally have an IP address that will link to an ISP where somebody's paying for service, and their name is there. So I just don't think this is a broken system. And I think AutoEmit is the example, is one of the good examples of why it isn't. Then I'd like to, is that?
You have another
minute. So, and I guess my other question, the reason I asked about studies is because I'm on a quest, and this is my challenge to all of you at South by Southwest, which is, could somebody who actually has real scientific skills please look at this question for us? And I've already challenged Dana Boyd to do this. She's on another panel right now, but and she's happy to run it if somebody else will help her. So I've got half of the way there. I think that we have a lot of anecdotes about anonymity, and frankly on both sides, on my side and on Colette's side of this. And as one of my good friends who's a statistician once told me, the plural of anecdote is not data. We need to actually know before we start passing laws requiring data retention or anything else, are we solving the problem of harassment by removing anonymity, or are we just doing something that's going to cause collateral damage and make us feel good?
Okay, Cindy, now we move to you preparing the affirmative statement, which is, what is the best case for allowing anonymity? You have 3 minutes to do this, and then Colette has a pair of two-minute segments for cross-examination and rebuttal. So 3 minutes, what is the best case for allowing?
Well, I'm going to go back in history a little bit because I do think that this is one of the areas, you know, often at EFF we're arguing about what the law ought to be in the future. And when it comes to protecting anonymity online, we're just trying to defend what the law was when it was decided, when this country was founded. And this country, as I mentioned, was founded on unpopular ideas by unpopular speakers. And they used anonymity in order to spread the ideas, whether it's the Federalist Papers or other early documents. Unpopular ideas, you know, sometimes require protection, and that's why part of why we have the protection of the First Amendment and freedom of speech in this country. Remember, you don't need freedom of speech protections to protect popular ideas. You need it to protect unpopular ideas. And one of the things that we're seeing now with social networks and the way the internet is happening is we're moving from a world in which our laws and what govern us every day are created by governments out of a social contract where we have things like separation of powers and constitutional rights that can't be, you know, that don't turn on whether the will of the majority supports us or not, to a world where these same decisions are being made by private actors who aren't accountable under the First Amendment generally for the rules that they make. And the question is, do we want to give up the deal that we struck in this country 200 years ago? Simply because most of our speech is now being hosted and organized by private entities, or not? So that's my rhetorical question. I could give you a litany. EFF has done well over 20 cases protecting anonymous speakers online. They're all on our website under anonymity. I can give you a whole bunch of stories, and maybe I should have for my best case scenario, but I can't help it when you can mention the Founding Fathers. I just think you gotta.
You've got
I've got more time.
Another 1 minute and 10
okay. Well, let me give you a couple of the stories. We've represented Urban Amicus in cases ranging from employers who wanted to do whistleblowing about wrongdoing in their employments, and they did it on like Yahoo. Yahoo had message boards for every publicly traded companies. These were very popular in the early 2000s, a place for shareholders and employees and corporate people to talk to each other. We handled a series of cases where we had whistleblowers unmasking undoing who would risk their jobs but if they were identified. We've had people who were criticized. We just won a case in Illinois about someone who was on a message board who was being critical of a candidate for local office. It turned out that actually he was debating the son of the candidate for local office, who himself was under a pseudonym, who then revealed himself and sued the guy for saying mean things about his mom. And demanded that the guy be revealed. But this is a small village township in Illinois, and the guy could face a lot of repression if it was revealed that he was criticizing a public figure who was somewhat popular. And we were able to protect that man's anonymity. The same thing happened in New Jersey in local politics.
Let's hold off on that, and you can save it for your next.
Oh, that was my minute. Wow, that was fast.
That was a fast minute.
I got a pocket full of these stories.
So now we turn the floor over to Colette. Colette has two-minute chunks. The first is a cross-examination, and then the second is rebuttal. If you do you have any questions you'd like to pose?
Yeah. So, Cindy, I'd like to know what you would have done differently in the Kathy Sierra situation. How would you have handled that differently?
I don't think Kathy Sierra's problem was that people were anonymous. I think Kathy Sierra's problem is that people were harassing her. I mean, I don't know that Kathy had a problem identifying people. That's never a part of the story that gets told. Because I don't know. I don't believe she filed suit, and I don't believe that she issued any subpoenas to any of the ISPs or the IP addresses. It's her blog, so she captured the IP addresses of all of these people to go backwards. So I think what happened to Kathy Sierra is horrible. I just don't think removing anonymity would have changed it. And I don't know that she took the steps that are already available to her to try to get accountability, and they failed.
You can reclaim your time at any moment.
Oh, I can cut her off.
Politely.
Okay. And I guess another question I have is, would you view it differently if the proposition isn't that we're asking or allowing the DOJ, the Department of Justice, or the FBI, or another government arm to unmask people, but rather the victims of these harms. Like, think of it as a sort of anti-stalking laws or like domestic violence situations where you can get a temporary restraining order, but you need to actually know, be able to articulate in the order who it is that needs to be restrained. And if the laws were such that it was really just for the victims to solve the problem rather than allowing government unmasking, does that help or change things?
Well, I just think you're positing a world that won't exist. You'll never have a situation in which only private entities can get your identity and the government never can. And I have a hard time. I mean, maybe, you know, if we could posit that world, let's just posit a world where people are nice to each other all the time, because I think they're both as likely. You know, there is a problem. There's something called the third party doctrine in the law that says when you give information to a third party like a social service provider, you've waived all of your privacy rights vis-a-vis the government, or at least a lot of them. That's another topic for a whole other thing. Yeah. But believe me, I want to take that mother down. And I have Justice Sotomayor on my side now. But it's a hard. It's not going to solve this problem, even if we get rid of the third-party doctrine.
Okay, now we move to rebuttal. Colette, you have 2 minutes to rebut the best case for allowing anonymity claim.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So Cindy's argument focused, of course, on the Founding Fathers, which I think is also very important. I'm not opposed to that. I actually think anonymous speech is very valuable. It just doesn't need to happen on your social site necessarily. There are places where these people can have their speech allowed, and maybe those social sites will have different views about how to enable that speech to happen in a safe way for the activists and the people who are trying to fight and change, you know, places where human rights violations are happening in very egregious ways. What I would like to focus on in the same kind of historical vein or sort of big policy, big picture vein is, you know, we live in a world that we would like, I'd like to believe is governed by the rule of law. And it seems like in a lot of these cases that I deal with, that I'm most familiar with, the victims of egregious harassment, they're living in a world where there is no rule of law. There is no way for them to use the law. The laws that exist, we don't even need a single additional law to be passed for most of these people. People are violating privacy rights. They're causing extreme emotional distress. They're defaming. They're doing all sorts of things online that, and being able to get away with it because there's very little ability for these people to effectively uncover who they are and move on. Although Cindy is absolutely right. I mean, in a lot of sites existing today, through a lengthy procedure of filing a lawsuit and doing a DOE subpoena, which does provide for due process, you actually have to show that you have a legitimate claim before you can unmask. Those steps are actually, I think, fair and good, but it's very difficult. And sites today could just choose not to log any information and choose not to have any of that information available. So finding the perpetrator and proving it's them is very difficult for victims. And I think that we want to enable the rule of law to exist for them as well as everyone else.
Okay, so now we move to what amount to closing statements. 3 minutes per side and a 2-minute rebuttal per side. Colette, are there any benefits to a social site and disallowing anonymity? Keep in mind this is also your chance for closing remarks.
Okay. I think there are numerous benefits, and it's not without some costs, so I don't want to be, you know, pretending like there is no cost for taking on and doing the right thing and trying to build a site that will allow for you know, civil debate. But the benefits are primarily that a lot of times more creativity will flourish in your site. You'll have an enormous opportunity for collective action, for organizing, for reaching niche communities, people whose comments and purposes are aligned with what you want to provide, what kind of home you want to create for your users, will more likely be in your control than if you had a place that's really truly open to everyone, in the anonymous sense. It will also do the right thing in terms of providing a path to justice for victims who are egregiously harmed through your site. I mean, you're providing a place where these harms are happening. Not that you should be accountable for what other people do without your knowledge, but you don't have to be a blocking mechanism for people who need to find a way to solve their problem in their real world experience. The costs are obvious. You're going to have to manage some information. You're going to have to deal with security. You're going to have to respond to subpoenas. You're going to need a process for that. I think there's opportunities for other creative entrepreneurs to create systems and things that could make that very, through technology, that can make that very effective and very efficient. We're not there yet, but there are services and things that are, I'm sure, being built today that can help with some of these processes. But it is the right thing to do, and I think that it will make a better place for everybody who wants to participate in an online culture. Oh, I have 20 seconds. I'll yield.
Okay. Well, we can add that later. Informally, Cindy, you have 2 minutes to respond, and you can use this time as you see fit. You can either use it for cross examination or rebuttal. You have 2 minutes.
I think I'll just do a clothing thing. I like the question and answer part of every panel the best, so I want to get there. I think that this is where I respectfully disagree with Colette. I think the right thing to do is to let people have freedom to say things that are unpopular on your space, to have the freedom to say things that aren't tied to their direct identity. And honestly, I think there's an argument to be made that that actually makes people safer too. I mean, for every person who wants to identify their harasser, there is a domestic violence victim or someone else who, for their own protection, needs to not be identified. And obviously, I think, again, with the Arab Spring, it's hard for me to even imagine why people don't get that forcing people to be identifiable makes them more, makes your community or the people who are in it more safe. I think people are more safe if they can obfuscate who they are when they're saying things that might piss off a government or an important player in their world. That's, I think, the right thing to do. It's the way that you keep people safe and you let people make their own choices. I think this is the other thing. I think there's a, you know, it, of course, it's your social site. It's your playground. I think when you get to be as big as, say, Facebook, though, and the only game in town, that there might be a different valence here. But for other than the woman who's here from Facebook, I think everybody else here isn't. So you're having a much smaller site and you can make a bunch of decisions for yourself about what role you want to play. But I think there is a measure of arrogance in deciding that people aren't capable of making their own decisions of when they need to protect themselves, when they need to have separate identities, and when they don't, and that you're going to make that decision for them. I think that you chill people's ability to participate freely as much on the other for making the decision to not allow anonymity as you do for allowing anonymity. And I think you create a situation in which, as long as you agree with the majority, you're happy to you're welcome to participate. But if you actually might want to say something that's a little different or come from a different perspective, you put people at risk.
Okay. So let's if these are closing statements, let's move to questions from the audience. I think that microphone's working. If you want to line up and identify yourselves, that would be great. Let me start by asking.
You can use a pseudonym if you want.
I didn't say you have to identify yourself using your legal name. I'll start by asking the first question, which is, Nicolette, would you want a new federal law doing anything on this? Do you want a new federal law saying that social networks have to keep IP addresses for 18 months or 2 years? Maybe ISPs keeping IP addresses for that amount of time?
Oh, I hate this question. this is a difficult question. I actually don't want to encourage massive new laws and regulations. I think a lot of this could be handled by companies deciding to do the right thing because it's the right thing to do. The data retention piece, though, is really difficult because if nobody is keeping any of that information, it's impossible for the victim to accurately and effectively identify this person who's, you know, stalking them online or doing whatever it is that's causing the harm. I would be in favor of some sort of system where the IP addresses and things like that can be traced for a short period of time. I mean, you don't want a victim to come back 10 years later and say, oh, you know, you did this to me 10 years ago, and now I need to, prove it and go to the big company and get
the data.
And
so is this yes or no to federal legislation of any kind in this area?
Right now in this – no, not right now.
Okay.
in this world, I don't really trust what Congress would do.
Yeah, be careful what you ask for when you go to Congress. If you want to identify yourself with a pseudonym, feel free.
My name's Cole. I just wrote a book about Anonymous, the hacker group, and they're not particularly fond of me. They cyberbully me, and use that word. Talking to a lot of hackers and security experts, I've sort of come to the conclusion that possibly dubious cliche about gun control, that those, if we make guns illegal, only criminals will have guns, sort of applies to the situation, and that hackers will always find a way, and not just hackers, but trolls who maybe don't even have any particular technical knowledge, will figure out ways to game the system and subvert any sort of rules without some kind of massive restructuring of what the internet is in order to enforce identity. So I was wondering if you both respond to that.
I agree. I mean, really, I was at a big cybersecurity meeting with a bunch of NSA and Department of Defense people last year talking about various issues. And one of the proposals that comes up in that context a lot is some kind of a driver's license to be online or something so you can always identify people. And what was remarkable about it is that the kind of marketing people and a lot of the people who were more promotional on the cybersecurity debate all thought this was a great idea. And me, the NSA guys and the Department of Defense guys were all like, you guys are crazy, right? You're just going to cause trouble for people who really need anonymity, and you're not going to stop the bad guys. And again, let me tell you, this you know, I think that people who actually understand how the internet technology works, this isn't a hard question to answer, and it wouldn't be a hard question to answer even if there wasn't Tor and some of the other tools that are available. The technology, talking about re-architecting the internet on a huge level to try to create a system where you have identities that can't be gamed by people who are committed to hiding their identity. I don't think it's doable.
Yeah. So the idea that there's always somebody who's going to work around the law is it's true. I mean, that you can't, it's hard. I can't say that that's not going to happen. The gun control analogy is actually quite, it makes a lot of sense to me. But I think we need to think about what we're giving up by not trying to work towards something that is better. The voices of women and a lot of other disenfranchised groups are disproportionately quashed on the internet. I mean, there's studies. I think Wikipedia did a study some time ago. 100,000 contributors, 15% of them are women. And they have goals to bring that up to 25% by 2015, but I don't know that that's, that's still only a quarter of the contributors on Wikipedia are women, and I wonder why that is. And that kind of makes me think about, well, why are, I mean, there could be a lot of reasons for it, but I think one of them is that it's just another place to get beat up and not want to, don't want to be in that environment. There's also, just looking at some statistics, these are a little dated from 2007, and in harassment, 61% of individuals reporting online abuse identify themselves as women, while 21% identify themselves as men. So, I mean, this is a problem that disproportionately affects certain groups, and I think that we need to remember when we just say, oh, we can't do it because technology doesn't allow for that, we're actually throwing all these people kind of under the bus in some ways. And I don't know, obviously I know that Cindy cares about all these things too. I'm not saying anything like that, but I do think
that... Far too polite.
No, but I mean, it's a really tough problem because I don't know, I know that there are people, I'm not a hacker, I'm not a commuter, I mean, I'm just happy my Apple works. I know that this is a difficult problem, but I think we have a lot of smart people who can try to work towards other ways to create communities, and maybe we'll end up, I mean, the scary thing might be to have like two separate internets, like the safe internet and the scary internet, but I mean, I don't know the answer.
And we also have 270 million plus guns in private hands in the U.S. and we probably have at least that many computers that can run Tor. So thank you. Let's move to the next question.
I am a search marketer, and I do believe in anonymous users. So
thank you.
But my, I sort of have a story that is more geared towards Colette. So I live in Baltimore. Baltimore has a huge problem with prostitution and drugs. And a lot of the ways that the Johns communicate is through anonymous forums. And it provides a great opportunity for the police to actually find out where these people are, and give these women help, because most of the time they resort to prostitution because of drug addiction. I guess what I'm asking is how do you weigh the benefits of what we can do with the information that people are willing to give because it's anonymous? How do you weigh that with what we give up?
So are you saying then that we're assuming that these Johns wouldn't, or drug people, whatever, wouldn't use any online medium to communicate anymore?
Well, I mean, I am using, if we outlaw anonymous users, across the board.
Yeah.
And for example, when I was living in a neighborhood called Big Town, it was sent through our local community forum group. And so we were able to sort of see what was happening in our community because these Johns had this anonymous profile that they were willing to let go of all this information, and they post, things from Craigslist that were ads, and it allowed the cops in our neighborhood to actually take real social action and help clean up our neighborhood.
Okay.
So for me, that anonymous user and that anonymity, or that
perceived anonymity,
perceived anonymity, great. Actually allowed for social change and social growth.
So I don't I mean, that's a great question. I mean, it assumes kind of the flip of what Cindy and I kind of somehow disagree on. I think, like, it assumes I'm right that if you make people use their real name, they'll be more careful about what they put under their name.
Yeah,
but there's no study. Yeah, but there's no study that I can point to that says yes, that's totally true. I think what I would say is, if they didn't have this online space, wouldn't they be doing it in the classified ads like they used to do it? Wouldn't they be doing it in other offline media that we've had for years? Is it just more difficult to find, and it costs the police longer?
And because of that, that's why I say yes.
Let me cut this off. We have four other people lined up, but thank you, Lynn. So next up is...
My name is A.B. I have a question for Cindy.
Mm-hmm.
I find that when users contribute content to online communities, you know, whether it's something intelligent or clever or funny or insightful, they tend to feel a sense of accomplishment and ownership of their contribution. Just generally, online users that contribute meaningful content, they tend to be a little narcissistic and egocentric about what they say. How do you think is the best way to get anonymous users to contribute meaningful content while feeling that it's worth their time? If someone says something insightful, why wouldn't they want to take credit for it? So what I'm really asking is, what's the best way to provide incentive for anonymous users to make meaningful contributions to online communities, given their egocentric nature?
Well, I think anybody who wants to be identified online should be. I'm certainly not saying you have to be anonymous. So if you have a narcissistic reason that you want to say something and you want to make sure everybody knows you said it, then say who you are. Nobody's stopping you from that. I think that when people choose anonymity or pseudonymity for a bunch of different reasons. Like, some people like to have a persona that's different in one community than it is for another. I know, I have a lot of friends who are in mom's groups, right? I mean, in their mom's groups, or I have a dog, right? I mean, the people at the dog park, they don't know my name. They know me as Cody's mom, right? And they wouldn't. It's useful to them to know that when I'm speaking on our little online news group that I'm Cody's mom. It's much less useful to them to know that my real name, because they don't know who I am. So
an option for anonymity.
An option for anonymity or pseudonymity, I think, gives people a way to connect what they're saying in a particular context to who they are in that context. And so, you know, you're always going to have people who say dumb things online, and they're going to say it whether they're anonymous or not. But I just think it's a choice thing, and you know, what you do is you let people decide for themselves how they want to be identified and whether they want to be identified, and they're in the best position to know the risk factors or the benefits to them in choosing one of these. And again, I just think social sites really don't have to take this problem on, right? Let your users do this, right? You don't have to be the nanny of your users and try to make these decisions for them, because frankly you're in a really bad position to try to make those decisions on behalf of your users.
Thank you.
Hi, my name is Jessica, and building on something I think that was said already, my question is also a little bit more for me. I don't think there has to be a divide between the scary internet and friendly internet, but I also don't really understand what the problem is with having it both ways. And I think I'm an editor, and I work at Yahoo, and I work with some of our social sites, so I'm in the weeds a little bit, in comments, and also I work on our Facebook page, so I look at how people comment there. And the divide between people that, use their real name and people that don't use their real name in terms of civility and, I think, the value of contributions can be pretty obvious between those two sites and kind of places where people seem to have a little more ownership over what they're saying, what their behavior is. And I tend to feel like the internet is such a big place, and content is available in so many different ways on so many different sites, and you have so many opportunities to voice what you want to say, that to me, I don't see the problem with some sites saying, I don't want to allow anonymous users, and other sites saying, like, bring it, be whoever you are, tell us, don't tell us, it doesn't matter. Because it's such a broad, venue for conversation. And I understand that the idea of the problem of policing it, but I also think if a company wants to take that on, it's their problem, and does there really need to be like a standard policy?
Well, I mean, companies are clearly free to decide whatever kind of community they want to build. I just want to make the case for why you shouldn't just assume that real names will stop harassment. Because I've been on Facebook, and people are damn mean to each other all the time. And so, again, this is why I'm asking for data, you know, rather than anecdotes, because I think that, you know, it's not my experience that people who have to be positively identified are nicer to each other and less likely to harass. It just isn't. And so I think, I think that people are worried about harassment online, and I'm worried about harassment online. Again, I've been on the Internet since before there was a World Wide Web. People are mean to each other, and everybody knows the phenomenon of the hacker who's personally perfectly willing to be obnoxious online, and then when you meet them in person, they're a little kitten. But I don't think that the problem gets solved by removing anonymity, and there are really, really downsides. So I think somebody who's building the next social network has to think about it. The other thing I think about, which I think is really funny that Yahoo has a Facebook page, but is that Facebook, for instance, is becoming the de facto place for a lot of stuff on the Internet. That's why I said I put Facebook in a slightly – with 800 million users, I put them in a slightly different position than a startup in terms of their responsibility, because, you know, we're starting to see in Colombia, for instance, there are ISPs that are offering Internet service, but it's not Internet service. It's Facebook service. That's all you get. So when you start to be a government in terms of the size and the scope and the difficulty in people making other choices whether to speak in your thing, then I think we have to start thinking about different kinds of responsibilities than a world in which we actually have low barriers to entry and anybody can start the next social network site and
so
all of
Cindy,
that.
So, Cindy, do we need any new federal laws? Can I ask you that, targeting social networks? They're that big? It's like maybe they should be regulated like a public utility. What do you think?
Well, I don't think so. I think that honestly what we need to – I mean, this is another a whole other panel for a whole other side, but I think if we actually fixed antitrust law, we wouldn't need new laws around this. And frankly, that's my answer to the network neutrality debate, too. You know, what we need is to figure out ways to foster competition. And if we actually fix some problems in antitrust law that my dear friends at the Chicago School created, I think we could do this without new laws. I think we actually have a legal framework that will do it, but we have to do some course correction.
We have a few folks who have been waiting patiently. Why don't we have you ask your questions in quick succession, and then, if there's time, the panelists can respond. So please go ahead.
Okay, so my name is Josh, and at my company, we handle it's not the harassment question, so you're taking it down a level. I got a dilemma. So we handle ratings and reviews for many of the products across the Internet.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, 100 million reviews and reach, you know, most of the retail sites around the world. And on one side, we have users that really want to have trust in those reviews, so they want as much context information as possible. And we find that if they have those Facebook identifications and profiles, they're really happy about those. They can see if the backgrounds match each other and have faith in those people so they build reviews. And on the flip side, we have the people writing the reviews, and we find out if they use Facebook, their review ratings use from probably about 4.3 to 4.8.
Right. Nobody wants to say anything mean if they're going to be identified.
Goes pretty far down.
Totally.
That's really interesting. How to balance that situation?
Well, hold off on responding to that, and let's go to anyone else waiting?
Hi, I'm Tyler. Kind of the flip side of the point about narcissism being behind in online comments. With online image boards such as 4chan, the anonymity seems to be one of the reasons why people are in such a fucking networking site. People have the permission to fail frequently and often, be obnoxious, be utterly stupid. And I think from that permission to fail without any sort of reputation effects, you get a lot of creativity that comes out of it. You think that non-anonymous commenting kind of stabs that in the foot.
Well, I think.
Hold on. If we have anyone else, let's take that and please.
I'll go back to something Colette said. I don't think Cindy actually responded to. She mentioned about TechCrunch. I thought it was a great point about how the forums out there where it's not anonymous are much more relevant. The content typically is a lot better. As an example of that, if you go to any of the discussion forums, and Craig goes, I don't know if a lot of people do that, but I go there just for the entertainment factor. It is exactly what Colette said. It's a race to the bottom. I don't care if it's about physics or pregnancy. It's just it's just flaming sessions. So there's no actual real good content there. And so along those lines, my question to you, Cindy, is say Facebook allowed people to post anonymously on your wall assuming you have a Facebook account, would you let people do that? And I think the answer would be, for most people, it would be no, because once it becomes a personal thing, once anonymous becomes personal, most people have a problem with it. But once it's, if it's against the community, I think you're all right with it. But if it's directed at you, what would your answer be?
Anyone else?
I think the current or the next, you know, specific legal debate in this context is going to be about ISP and OSP retention logs and retaining IP addresses. And for unsophisticated users, you know, 60% or more of the harassment going out there, they can eventually be unmasked. But as you pointed out, the barrier to that unmasking is very high. In this specific issue, is there a middle ground? Cindy, would you back some sort of initiative? You know, if I'm being harassed and I wanted to obtain some sort of court order, or there was a legal regime that it would allow particular logs to my Facebook page to be logged, and maybe more specific retention as opposed to blanket retention. And where do you see this debate going in that specific issue?
So we have four questions. From Josh, we have reviews site and Facebook. From Tyler, we have the creativity of anonymity. From two people who did not identify themselves, we'll call them Anonymous Green. We have anonymity and on Craigslist, no good content there. And Anonymous in Black, we have data retention. So we have a few minutes. Either of you?
I could say really quickly, just I'm going to pick and choose what I want to respond to. the 4chan guy, was that Tyler? Chris Poole made a great speech. Was it last year or the year
before? It was last year.
Last year at this conference that was just incredible on why anonymity is so important. And I wholeheartedly agree with it, and I think he can do that over on 4chan. He can make those choices. That community can decide that's what they want to value, and I think the choice is great. And if I don't want to be exposed to that or participate in that, I don't have to. My goal is to get people creating, you know, places that maybe that's not their main goal, and they can have a different set of goals. And if they want to do that, I think they should try to harbor a very civil environment. The only other thing I wanted to respond to specifically was this OSP-ISP question at the end. What you're talking about, I think, is a proposal that I've heard only a few times, but I think is intriguing. Don't know how it would get done well, but we could talk about it. Is this concept of notice and track. So you don't have to log until you've been notified of a real situation of badness happening. And then you track for whatever the court says the period of time is, or whatever the rules say the period of time is, so that the person who's been harmed can then take that evidence, not the past evidence that you didn't track, but the new evidence, and go for it. Go ahead.
Let me start with the last one, because we do have actually a legal case in which a BitTorrent tracker was required to turn on logging as part of the discovery requirements in litigation, and so therefore they were trying to create a situation in which they weren't tracking people who use the torrent tracker and were required by the court as part of the litigation discovery plan in order to turn it on. I think that was incredibly wrong of the court and overreaching and unfair. So I think that we may actually live in a world in which this selective tracking already exists. I think if you send somebody a notice not to destroy records, most people log at least initially. That we may actually live in that world right now, frankly. If you think a lawsuit is imminent that you might be a party to, you have to not destroy evidence. So as much as I don't like it, we may actually already live in your world. It's just that people aren't using that mechanism very much. She just told me two things. I think your review website, I think that's a really useful insight, right? Is that if you actually make people identify themselves, they're unwilling to say unpopular things. They're unwilling to say things. And so do we want an internet in which everybody's just, you know, placating each other? Or do you want an internet where you get information that might be hard for people to hear sometimes? In terms of 4chan, I agree. I thought Chris Poole's speech last week was great, last year, and about the kind of freedom and experimentation that people go in. I mean, one of the earliest, I think, things that made me excited about the internet was discovering that there were especially young people going online and trying on different identities, especially young people who are going through questions about sexual identity, and giving them a safe place to kind of try on different identities and be different people other than the ones they are. We're creating an internet in which everything is on your permanent record forever. And I think we're losing something as a society in terms of people being able to play with their identity here. And I think it's especially important for people who are marginalized. Whether I would want really evil, harassing things directed at me, nobody wants really evil, harassing things directed at me. I think my point here is that removing anonymity doesn't solve that problem. People are mean to each other and harass each other regardless of whether they can be identified. And this is where this is my sense. I mean, Craigslist might be a cesspool, but other places aren't. I don't think it has to do with anonymity. I think it has to do with what kind of community gets built up. But I don't think anonymity is the major player in this. Again, I think removing anonymity is a feel-good measure that people are pointing to because they're upset about the amount of harassment online. I get the upset. I just think you're pointing to the wrong solution.
Let's let that be the last word. Cindy, you have the last word. Colette, you had the first. So can you thank these two distinguished debaters? Okay.